Hi, this is your host, Gareth Rice, and you're listening to Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station. What you just heard was an arrangement of the main theme from the 90s RPG classic, Chrono Trigger, arranged and performed by the 8-Bit Big Band. We'll be joined by the Tony-nominated band leader, Charlie Rosen, who's had an extensive background in arranging for Broadway, orchestration, and composing for various film and television projects. Rosen utilizes his wide range of musical experience to create dynamic and engaging arrangements for the listener, which have definitely not gone unnoticed within the music sphere. He, along with Button Masher, received a Grammy nomination for their arrangement of Mennonite's Revenge, originally from the SNES game Kirby Superstar, and it was featured on the 2021 album Backwards Compatible. Speaking of that car-eating maniac, lovable marshmallow, here are some tracks setting up the interview, starting with the English theme song to the 4Kids TV show, Kirby Right Back at Ya, by Norman J. Grossfeld and Ralph Schuckett, then to the versions of Revenge of Mennonite from the original SNES soundtrack, with both phases Where You're Taking Over the Halberd by Joan Ishikawa, then some more underrated tracks from the 2017 indie darling Cuphead by Chris Madigan.
Cuphead and and his Pelmug man, they like to roll the dice. By chance they came upon a devil's game, and gosh, they paid the price. Paid the price. And now they're fighting for their lives on a mission fraught with dread. And if they proceed but don't succeed,
well,
the devil will take their heads.
Are you waiting for?
bum.
Why not take a quick break? Tune the radio.
There's
chores to do, there's leaves to rake. Strum the old banjo. You can practice your Lindy Hop.
Bum 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 bum.
And maybe later sing with your barber shop.
Why
not take a little quick break and come back for more? Or then come back for more. Or please come back for more.
Joining us today is Charlie Rosen, leader of the group The 8-Bit Big Band, which combines classic big band writing with familiar video game tunes. He, along with Button Masher, received a Grammy nomination for their arrangement of Mennonite's Revenge, originally from the SNES classic Kirby Superstar, and was featured on their 2021 album Backwards Compatible. How are you doing, Charlie?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. First off, congrats on the Grammy nomination. That's got to be super exciting.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it felt like the biggest long shot ever. I mean, I sort of submitted that being like, hey, you never know. You know, there's like 300 or so other things in this category. This is super niche. I like video game music, jazz in the global music scene is a pretty niche thing still. But you know what? Worth a shot. And I was in London playing at a board game cafe with a friend. And then suddenly my phone started blowing up and I was like, no way. You know, it was just sort of like, oh my God, I cannot believe this happened. It's very cool.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks. Hopefully they actually, you know, get to reschedule. As of right now, they have postponed them indefinitely due to the virus. Okay. But yeah, it was supposed to be the 31st of January, but they, out of safety, they postponed it. We don't know when it's going to be yet. Hopefully soon.
Yeah, hopefully they figure something out, like on Zoom or whatever.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I guess the first question is, what got you into jazz?
That's a great question. You know, I came from a very musical family. My mom is a classical bassoonist and a woodwind doubler, and my dad is an organ player and piano and all sorts of things, mostly like jazz and jazz adjacent, and like early jazz specifically is what he likes best, music of the 20s and 30s. And so I grew up listening to a lot of jazz and classical and large ensemble music and orchestras and big bands and everything in between, really. And so I was sort of primed for it. But when I started playing my own music, I wanted to, like, you know, play rock music and be in a band. And like, I played in a lot of ska bands in California. But then in high school, you know, there's the jazz band in high school, and I played drums in that. And that's what really got me into jazz, like, on my own. And then, yeah, just sort of like the normal track for a lot of, you know, a lot of kids who get into jazz, they play it in school and then in university, and then sort of, just build a community around it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like a lot of people, like they get into jazz like early and go from there.
Right.
Like going from that, like what are your influences?
Yeah, so I'd say like my main influences, it's a hard question to ask because I really do draw influence from so many different genres, and I sort of filter it through the delivery vehicle of big band. But what's funny about the term big band nowadays is it really refers more to an instrumentation as opposed to a genre of music, because traditionally big band music is like Count Basie and Frank Sinatra and Duke Ellington. Like these are big band music. But now contemporary big band really is just defining big band as a set of instruments, saying like five saxes, four trumpets, four trombones, four rhythm, maybe some strings. And you like to infuse all the genres that have influenced me over the years through that vehicle. So of course, you know, swing and big band, you know, as a genre are big influences on me growing up, but also orchestral music, classical, rock music, metal, funk, you know, R&B, really like a little bit of everything. So it's hard to like pick a few specific artists that really stand out to me, but as a big band arranger, I would say like I'm really heavily influenced by like Quincy Jones and like Nelson Riddle and the sort of like mid-century people who were doing this kind of writing and pushing big instrumentations into new, you know, fields of music.
Yeah. I guess, would you say that, like, would you, like, are there any specific big band techniques or in, like, things that you draw from when you create arrangements?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing about being a professional arranger is what we do is we analyze various kinds of music consciously and subconsciously and look at their DNA and go like, okay, what is the DNA that makes this genre of music? And a genre of music's DNA is like, it's melodic vocabulary, it's chord vocabulary, you know, it's rhythm and groove vocabulary. And then what I like to call it's accent, but what it is like articulation vocabulary, the way that people phrase things, the ornaments they put on notes, the tunings, you know, like, so those are the four like DNAs of what makes a style of music. And so technically, you pick apart those things and draw them into your own palette so that you can have this bag of tricks to use when you say, oh, I want to do a chart that sounds like Tower of Power. Okay, so like, what does that mean? That means they use these kind of straight 16th articulations often, these kind of horn voicings. And so the techniques that I like to use draw from the specific sounds of that are idiomatic to the style. But I'd say at the heart of it all, my big band writing and voicing technique comes from the Schillinger method, which is what Berklee School of Music uses to teach in their arranging classes, and the use of like what they call mechanical voicings, and just these techniques that were developed by Joseph Schillinger to like create strong sounding voicings, no matter how many voices you have or which ones you use, but like how to expand voices up and down so that they still feel full and strong based on the harmonic context. And I'm just gonna look, I'm pretty sure his first name is Joseph, but Joseph Schillinger. Yeah, I got that right. Hold on one sec. Just make sure. Give me one sec. I'll get my dog to stop barking. Okay, anyway, carry on.
Your dog was agreeing with you.
Yeah. Yeah. My dog loves the Schillinger method.
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually never heard of the Schillinger method. Can you elaborate on it a bit more? Is it based on like the four close like harmony kind of thing?
Yeah, it's based on the idea that like the two factors in creating a voicing are what, you know, the function of the melody in relation to the chord change that's going on around it. And so if, you know, the melody note is a root, then you have four-way close, you harmonize down. And things that are also function as roots are nines. Nines replace roots. If it's the third, you know, you go down, whatever. If it's the fifth or 13th, those are functionally the same. And then the seven. And so the voicing technique is, you may have heard of like drop two voicings, drop two, right, and four, right, drop three. It's that. Those are what they call the mechanical voicings. And so the idea being that like as the melody goes up, your voicing gets more spread out. If it make sure that you have the important notes on the bottom that give it fullness, which we refer to as the guide tones, being the third and the seventh, because those notes carry the most information about the harmony, except the root, obviously, which is covered by a bass player. And so when those notes are on the bottom of a voicing, they give a lot of harmonic and resonant support to the ones above it. So that's like the solely writing style. It all starts from there. And then once you add more voices and sections, it comes out of the same technique where you're like, okay, well then trumpets will do this. That'll be really solid. Trombones, really solid. What's on the bottom? The third's on the bottom. We're working our way up. Or maybe it's just octaves, but then you do the Schillinger voicings here. Or it's a sax solo, which is just the straight up Schillinger method, you know, with the octave double on the bottom, and that's four-way closed, or sometimes it's drop two. So I use those voicing techniques as the foundation for creating that sound of like classic big band writing. But sometimes, you know, again, it's genre dependent as well. Sometimes that technique sounds too traditionally big band to be the thing. Sometimes you just want all unison, or sometimes you just want only triads. So I use it, but I depart from it often all the time.
Definitely. You don't need to be like set to one thing. You can
Right.
modify it if you need to. I guess, what inspired the creation of like the 8-Bit Big Band?
Totally. It's a great story. I actually love telling this story. I have always loved video games and video game music. So sort of like, you know, in passing, I did an arrangement of Bob on Battlefield when I was in high school, and that was, and then left it. And it was, that was great. And then didn't really think about it until much later. In 2016, I took a trip to Japan just for fun. And while I was there, I wanted to buy a shamisen. It's like a traditional Japanese sort of string instrument that you play with, sort of hold it like a guitar, but it has three strings and a neck. And I bought one there. I wanted a lesson on it. And so my friend Zach Zinger, who plays in the 8-Bit Big Band, he's a sax player, but he's also really into shakuhachi, which is a traditional Japanese woodwind. Mm-hmm. So he said, oh, you know, my friend Oki-san like lives in Tokyo. It plays koto and shamisen. You should go take a lesson with him. Great. I met up with that guy. Unbelievable. So nice. Great player. We had a lot of fun. It was really, really awesome to connect with him. And he had a soundtrack in his studio for Ganbare Goemon, which they've only released one or two games in America. And they go by Mystical Ninja, starring Goemon, which is one of my favorite random games for N64. And I said, oh, I love that soundtrack. And he said, oh, do you like video game music? I said, yeah, I do. I do, yeah. I've never really said it out loud until right now, but like, I really do, actually. I love soundtracks. And he gave me as a gift his album. And he has a band called Famikoto, which is like Famicom, the name for the NES in Japan. And Koto, which is sort of like a traditional Japanese harp-like instrument, like zither. And what he does with that band is he arranges all video game music for traditional Japanese ensembles. So yeah, really cool. And I was listening to it on the plane back thinking like, man, this is so cool. It sounds so awesome. Like, I really want to do something like this. And I had already been into big band. I have a big band in New York called the Broadway Big Band. I mostly do theater stuff and they play a lot of Broadway stuff. I thought, you know what? I'm going to record an album of video game music for big band. And I got home and I immediately started working on our first album, went into the studio and came up with the 8-Bit Big Band, and we did it. And at that time, I was fully not aware that there was such an insanely huge and devoted fan base and scene and culture of video game music appreciation on the internet and YouTube and MAGFest and, you know, and wherever, VGMCon. You know, I didn't know any of that. I just did it because I wanted to do it. Then I, as a result of putting those up on YouTube, and the first person who I made contact with was Insane in the Rain, was Carlos, and he reposted a video. I didn't know who he was, and suddenly we had a lot of followers all of a sudden from this one or two videos, and I started, you know, chatting with him like, oh man, I just checked out your channel. This is incredible. This is so cool. And that's how I sort of like discovered like, wow, there is such a scene for this. And yeah, that's how it started.
Cool. Yeah, when you do arrangements, what primarily determines what video game tunes you'll arrange and how they're adapted to a video game format?
Yeah, there's a couple ways I go about it. Usually, it's just OSTs that I love. It's soundtracks that I love and I've always wanted to arrange. But I'm but one man and one man can't play every video game. And so I really do rely often on recommendations from fans and listeners who leave comments or are in our Discord. There's a whole suggestions channel in the Discord that I check all the time to discover new soundtracks that I have overlooked or I've never heard of or are new. Cause you know, I'm of a generation which I'm not like super, you know, I'm of the N64 generation. So sometimes I need help with like newer niche games or like especially indie games that people are really loving. So I take recommendations all the time. So then after that point, the question is, there's like two approaches. Either, and especially with retro games, because the technology at the time was limited, I either go, okay, it was the 8-bit, 16-bit era, sound, you know, fonts and chips and synthesis was limited. I hear what you're going for. You were going for this style with the means that you had. So I'm gonna take that and like totally run with it and fully realize it in the way that you intended, you know, but just fully orchestrated. While still adding in my own sections, solo sections, interludes. Oftentimes, you know, in old games, the loops are only 30 or 40 seconds long. And so they'll often need like a B section. So I'll write a B section that sounds sort of like the theme. You know, I'll take the theme and I'll develop it into a full form. The other way that things go is sort of the reverse, where it's a more modern game and it already is like a fully produced track, for example, Still Alive from Portal. And then I go, okay, we're a big band. This isn't a fully produced song. So I'm going to go the other direction and like retro it and be like, okay, we're going to play the big band version of that. But all of my arrangements, they always come from like some sort of seed of dramaturgical idea that you can say in the English language. Like I find that to be really important to give the idea for an arrangement. So for Portal, I was just, you know, I think I was in the shower and I was sort of like singing the tune. I knew I wanted to cover the tune. I'm sort of like, you know, what if like, what's so great about people like Frank Sinatra, you know, and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. is they would hear these Broadway show songs and they'd go, oh, it's a great song. I want to do it. You know, I want to do it in my style. I'm going to ask the composer of this Broadway show if I can sing New York, New York, and I'll have Nelson Riddle arrange it. So now my idea for that was, okay, well, what if Frank Sinatra had played Portal and went, oh, that's a great song. I'm going to sing that, you know, and let's, so there's always this like English seed of an idea you can say in words, like, and that is, what if Frank Sinatra played Portal, you know? So having those little kernels of arrangements ideas that inform all of that. And then once you have the idea, you know, another example being Tetris. Okay, Tetris is, the Tetris theme is a Russian folk song that I am going to mispronounce if I try and say it, but it's a Russian folk song. So then I went, okay, great. I'm going to do that, fully expand it. What are other genres and things that are sort of circular in the tangential to that idea? So like other Russian folk songs, horas, Balkan stuff, things from Eastern Europe, you know, other classical, Tchaikovsky, you know, Russian classical composers. So then it becomes like, here's the kernel. What other tangential influences can I now throw into this kitchen sink to make it, you know, a cool idiomatic, thematic arrangement?
Going off of that, you've got like quite an extensive background working with musicals. Like how has that specifically informed your musical language when you arrange?
Or just totally. Yeah, great. That's a great question because I treat them exactly the same. And so the thing that's really great about working in theater is that, similar to what I was saying about video game music and big band being a delivery vehicle, right? So theater and subsequently film scoring also functions this way as well. Those are all mediums with which to deliver an experience. And every Broadway show is a different genre of music, right? Every video game is a different genre of music. So to be an arranger, an orchestrator in the theater, you have to have a really wide variety of vocabulary of all these styles so that if you go, oh, that's this style, okay, I know what I'm gonna do. So it's really the same in video games. I treat it exactly the same. I go, okay, this video game's going for this style. And so I can pull out my vocabulary in this particular style to now fully realize this song. And what we do as arrangers, I like to say, is an arranger, producer, orchestrator, music director, you know, there's all sorts of names, producer, they're all these names, but basically what all those things do is you hear unrealized potential in a piece of music and you flesh it out, right? So I treat, the way I treat this ensemble is exactly the same way I treat working on a Broadway show, albeit with a lot more freedom because there's nobody, like I just do what I want to do. I don't answer to anybody. Where in a show, you really are trying to realize the composer's vision. And which we also do, but because this is a big band and it's jazz and it's not professionally direct with the composer, I have freedom to do whatever I want with these pieces of music.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Considering that, like I've noticed like you put like a bunch of like jazz references in your arrangements and stuff. And so yeah. Like with Chrono Trigger, that's like a huge jazz fusion thing.
Totally.
And, like you did that Jaco.
Right. And again, like England, what inspired that is like what the kernel of that was just the chord changes, you know, these parallel minor nine chords, that just the motion of those chord changes and the quality of them just felt so jazz fusion-y already. And so once I thought, oh man, this is like such a Chick Corea, you know, chord progression thing. Then it was like, okay, well, I got it. You know, then I'm like, oh, what about, I'll put Jaco in there. You know, like, oh, you know, what bassline would work really well with these chord changes is like the Jaco bassline. So then it's like, that's the jumping off point.
Yeah, the matrix of music.
Exactly, yeah. Once you enter, yeah. Once you take the blue pill. Do you take the blue pill? You took the blue pill, right?
Blue pill, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I guess I'll pivot to it's like a different thing what you're talking about, but you did like some composition work on the 2021 movie Here Today, starring Billy Crystal. So I'd like to talk to you about like what was your approach on working on that film, because the story is like really specific, because
Like
an old man working with dementia and trying to figure out his life.
You know, and that is such, being a film score composer is such a different skill to being just an arranger. I like to say that the composers are the architects, and the arrangers or orchestrators or producers, what have you, they're sort of, we're sort of like interior designers, you know, like the composers construct the building, and then we decide what it's going to look and feel like when we arrange and orchestrate. And that those are two completely different skills that don't, that do overlap. It's a Venn diagram, but the ability to see a visual and go, this needs this feeling, but I have to, I need to stay out of the way. I need to make sure that the focus of the piece of music is still the characters of the film. That's what's in the foreground. It's just a different, it's a different approach. Whereas with the Ape at Big Band, the focus is the arranging. And in a film score situation, the focus is the film. So it's a different skill to just comment enough to where people don't notice, but it feels like something. And it's hard. It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. If you can do it well, then like that really elevates the medium of what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really easy to overdo it. And that's really hard for me because I'm such an over the top writer, as if you can't tell through, so it takes a lot of restraint for me to be like, no, just two notes is fine actually here, you know?
Yeah. Full of miles.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Space.
I guess like, as you probably noticed throughout your career, there's initially like a stigma against video game music. It's not like people said, like, it's not taken as seriously as its musical contemporaries.
Yeah.
So would you say that that stance has evolved over the years, like the rise of like more VGM artists?
Definitely. And I think it's now. I think we're in the golden era now. It's happening because the technology has evolved to a degree where like video game scores are film scores. Like they are music. They're fully fleshed out, realized, and professionally produced and polished pieces of music, you know? And so, but a lot of people still don't realize that. And when I do interviews and people ask me things like this, especially with slightly older musicians who want to know like, what's the deal with video game music? You know, I send them the video of the recording session of Mario Kart 8, you know, and it's just slamming. They're just crushing. This band is crushing. And I think that's an example. Or I send them the recording session of Super Mario Galaxy, you know, and they go, oh, this is music. You know, it's not just bleeps and boops anymore. And it hasn't been for a long time. And even the bleeps and boops were composed very, very well with extreme limitation. And they still achieved great melodies and implying harmony. But it's still like, we're still getting people to really take it seriously. And we're in an age where now people don't have the barrier to entry where the technology wasn't there. And also, what's great about doing what I'm doing now and what many other people on the internet are doing covering video game music is it's creating what I'm calling, and I hope people are also calling, like a great video game songbook, you know, where we have standards. And much in the same ways that these arrangers in the mid-century were covering, and the, you know, the Great American Songbook, like with Ella and doing all these arrangements and codifying a songbook, we are now doing that with video game music. And to me, that's like a huge step towards a collective experience with this music, you know, and giving it an air of legitimacy finally in the public eye. And, you know, not to toot my own horn, but a Grammy nomination doesn't hurt either.
Nope, doesn't hurt at all. Yeah, because like there's so many like games that people are like, oh, like video game music is like, I guess what I'm trying to say is like, oh, you could show them Child of Colossus and it's like, oh, it's beautiful. And if you say it's video game music, it's like, oh, okay. But if you like, if you did it the reverse, it's like,
right.
Oh, or like right. Undertale, the whole right. Leitmotif concept.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I think people are starting to come around to it. I mean, and when I say people, I mean people that either didn't grow up playing video games or were a little too old to play them, you know, we're getting there. We're getting there.
Yeah, we're getting there. What you were saying about the video game soundbook, like as you may know, like one of your colleagues in the video game space, like Insane in the Rain Music, recently announced his retirement from YouTube.
Yeah,
and like one of the reasons that he cited was like he wanted to avoid any legal ramifications for doing like covers of video game music.
Right.
And I guess technically you fall into that category as well. Right. So right. I was wondering, what are your current thoughts about like copyright law, or if there should be any changes to kind of better accommodate this like landscape for musical artists?
Yeah, I think there really needs to be. And it's a tricky thing because, you know, to cover any other pop music or music that's in just the body of songs that have been written, if you want to cover a Paul Simon song or whatever it may be, like there are very easy vehicles with which to do that. And it's not as easy with video game music. And so we're all existing in this sort of like gray area where the video game companies allow it, but it's not really legal, and they're well within their rights to do something about it. But hopefully there is a more easy and mutually beneficial, you know, mechanism put in place for people who really just want to honor the music while also making sure that Nintendo or Sega or Sony get their cut, can do that, you know, and we'll see, hopefully, knock on wood.
Yeah, definitely. And then just the whole issue of like video game soundtracks on YouTube, it's technically not legal, but there isn't a good alternative. Like, for example, like Chrono Trigger, like a lot of soundtracks are being taken down. But if you go on Spotify, you just get the compressed DS version, which isn't the highest quality. And then it's like, if you want to learn this tune, if you want to learn the harmony, like, where are you going to go? Are you going to like leave Chrono Trigger running for the rest of the day on your TV? And
right. Yeah, I mean, it seems inevitable because I feel like it must be a real headache for the legal departments of these video game companies, because they can't put out all of these little copyright fires. There's just no way. Like, as soon as you put out one, like seven more are going to pop up on some other platform. So I don't know. We'll see. It's incredibly, incredibly complicated. It makes my head spin a little bit. So I understand why Carlos is like, I don't want to be a part of it. I'm done.
Yeah. And then he said he was going to focus more on original music, which is definitely like a great step if you want to focus.
Yeah.
On
that. Yeah. That's great. That's great for him.
I guess for a bit of levity, would you consider changing the name to the 8-bit big band to the 16-bit big band, depending on what arrangements you're doing?
Or yeah, you know, people comment on that a lot, where they're like, this is from the 64-bit era. And I'm like, I know it is. It's just, I thought that the term 8-bit was encapsulating and obvious that it was video game music. It's funny because I said earlier, I didn't know there was really a scene, and I put out this album only to realize that like there are so many other artists that have 8-bit in their name already. And now it's kind of like, oh, I thought I was so original. And if only I had just done a little Googling, I would see that maybe there's some other title for the band that doesn't have, you know, because having 8-bit in the name of your artist name is a little bit of a cliche I've sort of come to realize in the world of video game music. But you know what? I stand by it. I stand by the 8-bit big band.
Well, it's kind of like you play like 70 plus musical instruments. It's not like you're going to say, I play 70. I play all, like, you primarily play bass, right? But you wouldn't advertise all that stuff. But
what happened with that is the New York Times did an interview with me, and I do play a lot of instruments, and they made me take out every single instrument I own, big and small, and count them. And so, you know, it's a little like I have six different sizes of a recorder, and so those all got counted, you know what I mean? But they are one recorder. It's all recorder. So it's like a little bit hyperbolic, but I do own 70 instruments, and I play a lot. I mean, all things with necks are what I say that I feel really comfortable on. So I went to college as a bass player, but I play a ton of guitar and all the things that come with it. So banjo and mandolin and ukuleles. And I'm really into brass. There's a corner of my room over there. There's a tuba, got my trumpet. I have my French horn. I have these flugelbones, which are sort of like marching trombone kind of things. Got my flugelhorn. And my mom is a woodwind doubler, so I grew up playing a lot of woodwinds. I took flute lessons when I was younger. And I still play flute, and I've been getting really into clarinet. And I just got a tenor sax, which is really fun. I'm getting really in. getting back into sax. I used to play a lot of sax in high school. Yeah, and obviously I had a ton of piano. And when I was in high school, I thought I was going to go to Berklee as a drummer, actually. And then I ended up auditioning on bass. So I do play like a lot of different things.
Nice. Yeah, I guess, do you have any future projects or anything coming up?
We've started working on our fourth album. I don't know what it's going to be called yet, but we've got maybe four or five songs recorded, and the videos to go with them. So that, and then I've got, you know, a couple Broadway shows coming out, that I'm the orchestrator on, that, you know, one's called The Strange Loop and the other is, a Broadway version of the movie Some Like It Hot, which will be cool. What else? You know, those are the kind of big ones. We'll see what happens with the Grammy Awards. You know, dang, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh no, I can't say it. Never mind.
Ooh, surprise, huh?
I orchestrated and arranged and produced songs for a film that's kind of a big one that I can't say what it is publicly yet on the air, but it will come out in 2023. So if anybody wants to maybe deduce what that might be, feel free.
Keep the mystery going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hold on a second.
You also did additional drum work for Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah.
What was that like?
That was a funny session. It was really fun. Essentially, my friend Josh Plotner, who plays in the 8-Bit Big Band, was contacted by... totally blanking on the developer's name. Rockstar. Wow. And they said they needed some music for like a show band, like a circusy show band that we were like, great, okay. And they gave us a couple songs that they know they wanted, and I played drums and Josh played reeds, and we got a cornet player and a tuba player and a piano player. And we just sort of like watched these animatics of like, it's the theater in Saint Denis. It's all these theater acts. So there's like a fire juggler and we just watched these animatics and we're like, okay, we'll just, you know, make up some stuff to play. So if you go to the theater, that's us playing. I'm playing drums, weirdly enough, on that. And it's pretty cool. The piano player, my friend Natalie, who plays in the 8-Bit Big Band.
Oh yeah, yeah.
They ended up using her as the motion capture for all piano players in the whole game. So all the motion capture piano, all the piano playing characters in the game are her.
Yeah. So thanks so much for being on the show.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Do you have any tracks like that you'd like to play it with? Any like particular ones that you like?
Yeah, I guess I have to choose from stuff we've already released. You mean you're just going to play us out with something, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, totally. Well, I think one of my favorites is like the last track off of our third album, which is the Super Mario World end theme, because it really is like, it's big band, it swings. It also has some like kind of a Broadway thing in it, like a classic Broadway thing, which is like harkens to the other side of my career. And the band just sounds so good and it's so fun. It's one of my favorites we've done.
Thanks to Charlie Rosen for being here on the show. What you heard before the interview was the English theme song to Kirby Right Back at You, the original Halberd themes from Kirby Superstar, and Don't Deal with the Devil, Introduction, Forest Follies, A Quick Break, and Hurry Up from Cuphead. We'll end off with the Grammy-nominated arrangement of Mennonite's Revenge, combining both themes from the original game, an up-tempo take on Gourmet Race, also from Kirby Superstar, and finally finish with the ending theme to Super Mario World, all from the 8-Bit Big Band's recent album, Backwards Compatible. This is Canadiana Suite, signing off.